Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So it's the last 3 days of this election campaign and it's all hands on deck. Boris Johnson is starting his last few days of campaigning in the North East at a fish market in Grimsby. Katie, where is the Conservative campaign at the moment?
A range in the polls, but they still predict a Tory lead, and that lead is anything from 6 points to 14 points. Now, anything below 7 points is when Tories will be a bit jittery because you can't quite predict how that vote falls. So it could lead to majority, it could lead to a hung parliament. I do think the Tories feel a bit more confident than perhaps this time last week. And I mean, now they're into the stage doubling down on their messages and trying to get the vote out. And I think you're going to see Boris Johnson, as James wrote in his Sun column, trying to, you know, get out and about. But you're also going to see, you know, one thing that's happening is big digital spend by the Tories. So it's really all about hammering that message home. And the starting point is to go to lots of Leave Labour seats, the so-called red wall, where we know Boris Johnson and the Tory seat is key to picking up seats to make up for any losses and winning a Tory majority. And then from there, he's going to visit every region in England and Wales over the final few days. Again, hammering that message home, he is not going to Scotland in the final few days, which I suspect, given that the Scotland polls look fairly good for the Scottish Tories, isn't because that is seen as a no-hope place, but perhaps because if you're thinking of what's going to help with your vote, Boris Johnson isn't necessarily a thing which is, you know, should be front and centre. Actually, in Scotland, it's just all about that union message.
James, Jeremy Corbyn instead is touring Bristol as the start of his campaign. Is he not worried about the red wall?
I mean, there is a problem for Jeremy Corbyn, which I don't think he necessarily helps in these seats. I mean, the voters that Labour have trouble with are particularly found in, or a large number of them, Labour leavers, are particularly found in these seats. You know, Jeremy Corbyn's appeal is not necessarily to those voters. I think, you know, I think very oddly some Tory candidates in those seats were rather hoping that Jeremy Corbyn would come because they think that they worry about the Labour candidate trying to disassociate themselves from Jeremy Corbyn, to say kind of vote Labour rather than vote Corbyn. I think Katie is right about the Tories feeling a bit more confident. I think we're now in a situation where there are still three things that can stop a Tory majority, but all three of them would have to happen. And that is tactical voting on a large and unprecedented in British electoral history scale. You basically would need Remain voters to say, right, we're going to go out and vote to stop the Tory. I think that is probably the biggest single risk. The second is differential turnout. The Remain voters are energised. Leave voters think, oh, it's a bit cold, it's a bit wet today, maybe I'll stay home. I personally think that is unlikely, in that I take the view that the weather doesn't really affect turnout in the way that people think it does. I think it did in the pre-automobile era, but now people have cars and umbrellas. I think
a lot of elder ladies might be getting lifts offered to them by perhaps Tory campaigners.
And then the third thing is, a lot of elections, I mean, the country as a whole, the UK as a whole, is going to become more like Scotland, and there'll be fewer safe seats and more marginals. And the third thing that would need to go wrong for the Tories is that all those races that are decided by under 1,000 votes, you know, if they would need to fall massively disproportionately against the Tories. Now, that is possible, right? You know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. You know, every time you toss the coin, the odds reset and all that. But again, I think it's that all three of those things would now have to happen to deny the Tories a majority. So it is still possible, but I think the chances of a Tory majority are ticking up. And I think as to go back to what Katie was saying about, you know, look at what happened last week. Donald Trump came and didn't ignite a firestorm. Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn had a debate on Friday night, and it didn't change the debate about this election. You know, I don't think we're discussing anything different this morning than we were discussing on Friday morning. And that is a result for the Tories in the context of that debate.
Yeah, and on tactical voting, we're getting a press conference today from Best for Britain and the People's Vote, where they are going to be unveiling what they see as the final Remain option for each constituency. So trying to hammer the message home that if you do want to stop the Tories winning a majority and thereby the UK leaving the EU in every constituency, this is the MP you should go for. Now, I think what would be interesting is, will that have any cut through? I still think it has been the case that lots of tactical voting sites seem to suggest different things for various constituencies, which is why I've been a bit sceptical of how effective it would be. Because, for example, in Kensington, I've heard people say they're going to vote tactically, but sometimes they say they're going to vote Labour tactically, and other times they say they're going to vote Lib Dem. So if you have inefficient tactical voting, it doesn't get you the desired result. Perhaps this will have cut through, but I think unless Joe Swinson and Jeremy Corbyn actually come together and say, look, guys, they're very close to this. This, you don't vote for this candidate here, vote for the Labour candidate and vice versa, I think it's still going to be fairly hazy and grey in enough seats, even if people try to do it. I just don't know if there's enough clarity in quite a lot of these seats. I think in some seats it's easier to do than others. For example, in Canterbury, I think that Rosie Duffield, a Labour candidate, has had a lot of press, partly because she had the first Lib Dem candidate, Tim Walker, stand down. Then Lib Dems put another candidate in. But through that press to a degree, I think you've had enough cut through that actually that's a very close fight, and if you want to stop the Tories from winning it back, you're best to vote Labour. But not every seat is like that. And I think a lot of seats are a bit more confusing. I mean, we're speaking now from the marginal seat of Cities and Westminster. And I think some would say Chickaramina is the person you should vote for. But I've also heard people say, well, Labour came very close last time. I think, James can correct me if I go wrong, closer than the Lib Dems did.
Yeah, Lib Dems got less than 10% of the vote.
So again, I don't think it's 100% clear right now, even depending what Best of Britain say,
right,
who in this seat you would vote for to stop the Tories. And I think that's one of the problems of it.
James?
I think it's right in that, interesting, if you talk to the Tories, one of the seats they are downbeat about is Canterbury.
Mm.
Partly because Rosie Duffield is getting that kind of incumbency bounce. You know, she won in 2017 and she's worked hard as a local MP. You get a certain uplift for that. But also, as Katie said, because the tactical voting case has been made clearer there than it has been elsewhere. I think if you look back, the last time you saw large-scale tactical voting in Britain was 1997. But in 1997... Labour and the Liberal Democrats had essentially spent 5 years in Parliament cooperating with each other against the Tory government. The Labour leadership, Paddy Ashton and Tony Blair, were very close. And that kind of all the way down, that filtered through. We're now in a situation where Labour and the Lib Dems have been knocking lumps out of each other. Joe Swinson says Jeremy Corbyn is unfit to be Prime Minister. Jeremy Corbyn says that Joe Swinson enabled austerity and people died and all this. So I don't see the kind of the bond between Labour and the Liberal Democrats that would need to exist to facilitate large-scale tactical voting as being present. I really cannot imagine a scenario where between now and Thursday, either Joe Swinson or Jeremy Corbyn urge people to vote for the other party where necessary. And I think without that kind of big national prompt moment, then it is hard for the Remain side to maximise tactical voting.
Katie, there was also a fascinating report over the weekend in the Times that said that Labour is not actually going to this election to win, that Labour people are already looking ahead at what happens afterwards, and what happens afterwards is Corbyn getting ousted and John McDonnell coming in as caretaker.
Yeah, there are a few currents to the story, but ultimately it's the idea that is Labour actually more focused on what happens in the aftermath of defeat than winning this election? Now, I still think there are enough people in the shadow cabinet who really believe that they could have a repeat of 2017, but by that actually go a little bit further and that this time make it into a win by which there is going to be a minority government. But it cannot be denied that this is a Labour Party which for over a year now has been looking at what happens if they don't win. And I think the clearest sign came at Labour conference, where on the eve of it, when it should have been about, you know, geeing up the group, the membership about this election, they ended up trying to change the rules, and specifically successfully changing the rules on interim leaders. So the fact that if, for example, Jeremy Corbyn were to quit after losing an election, perhaps a few hours after that result came through, you can now have an interim leader who would just have to be approved by the NEC, the National Executive Committee, which, by the way, is weighted in favour of Corbynism. So you can start to see how someone could just step in and hold the fort until there is a suitable time to actually go through the democratic process of letting members and MPs choose who they actually want to lead them. Now, the reason I bring up something that happened a while ago is this report is suggesting that perhaps John McDonnell could take advantage of what was voted on in that meeting. So the idea being that if Labour do not win enough seats to forge a minority government or at least even hold power-sharing talks, Jeremy Corbyn could signal that he wants to step down quite soon, potentially as soon as Friday. But you wouldn't go straight into a Labour leadership contest. Instead, John McDonnell would step in. He would get his shot at being Labour leader without having to go through the normal stages to do so. And then the idea would be you would have a slow build for the new Labour leader up until probably Labour conference. I believe that is autumn. Clearly, I mean, I don't think there's been a straight out denial. There's been some suggestion that isn't completely on the money. I think that there is a sense, if you speak to those fairly close to Jeremy Corbyn, that they don't think if he loses this election, he plans to stay on long term, that he wouldn't lead them into another election. So you start to get into succession planning. And I do think that they perhaps wouldn't want to go straight into that contest because, yes, there are pro-Corbyn candidates who would carry on what he wants. And I do think any Labour leader, to be honest, would have to stick to some strains of Corbynism. The membership has changed. I don't think you could move back to Blair. But it is the case that Keir Starmer or Emily Thornberry, I think, would move Labour to a more central position than, say, Laura Pidcock or Rebecca Long-Bailey or Angela Rayner. So that's the fight, and I think there'd be a nervousness amongst lots of Corbyn's closest allies that if he went straight into a contest after a defeat, it could help perhaps more established candidates like Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry.
James, what are the chances of this being a way to pull Labour back from the brink of the hard left in this opportunity? I mean, could moderate MPs like Jess Phillips, of the Social Democrat faction, could they be seeing this as an opportunity, and would they win?
I think the quite challenge is the Labour membership has changed quite fundamentally. And the only way I can see someone from the Social Democratic faction of the party winning is if either the defeat is much worse than people are, and if it is a defeat and it is much worse than it is anticipated, and it kind of acts as a kind of bucket of cold water sobering people up, or if they use this time to go on some kind of massive membership drive to try and get people to sign up who are not currently in the party. I think one of the reasons why the Corbynites would like to drag the contest out is their two favoured candidates, Rebecca Long-Bailey and Laura Pidcock, they both are not, to put it mildly, household names. I mean, they would want to kind of do what Michael Howard did with David Cameron and that reshuffle, which is kind of give them higher profile roles that allow them to become kind of more noticed by the country. It's very telling that Rebecca Long-Bailey was put up for that first seven-party debate on the BBC. And so I think that'll be the strategy. I think the Labour, though, if Labour do lose this election, they face two existential questions. One is, do you just try Corbynism without Corbyn, or do you try and come back to the centre? And what is your attitude to the EU? Is your attitude that, look, Brexit's happened, it's done, let's move on? Or is your attitude to argue for as close an economic relationship as possible, but without membership, a kind of return to the kind of 2017 Labour position from that manifesto? Or do you go the whole hog and become a kind of rejoin party? I suspect that the answer is probably of those three options. The second is the most likely, because the Lib Dem threat to Labour has not materialised in this election to the extent that people expected, while as the threat in its leave voting seats has. So I think the idea of going full rejoin is probably far too much now. But I think there will be a tension about that second point. I mean, how explicit to be about that? And then that runs you into this whole question of, obviously single market membership would bring up the whole question of free movement. So, what is it that you go for as a Brexit policy?
James, if the Social Democrats miss this next opportunity, does that mean Corbynism without Corbyn will be baked in into the Labour Party? I mean, are we going to see the Labour Party going back to the moderate form anytime soon?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be certain of anything in politics. It's worth remembering that when Neil Kinnock won the Labour leadership after Michael Foot's defeat in 1983, Neil Kinnock was seen as being a candidate of the left. And he then set about deliberately moving the Labour Party back to the centre in quite a systematic way. I think Angela Rayner, not so subtly, clearly sees herself as a Neil Kinnock style figure, someone who is of the left but could begin that march back towards the centre.
James and Katie, thanks very much.